All right. Well, good day. Welcome back. With me today is Dr. Frank Cogliano. He's professor of history at the University of Edinburgh. This year, he's at Monticello. I'm going to let he'd tell you more about that and what he's doing at Monticello. He's on campus as part of our Wade Lectureship Series, talking about his book, A Revolutionary Friendship. And the engagement is this evening, but it will have copies in the library for folks to check out and to read. Professor Cogliano, thanks so much for joining us today.
James, thanks for having me. It's a it's an immense pleasure to be here. I've so enjoyed my time in Owensboro so far.
That's great to hear. It's a great town. Loved having you. There's so much more to your introduction, and I'm going to try to kind of save some of that for this evening, but there's a lot to your bio.
I'm old, James. That's what you're telling me.
This is Professor Cogliano's 10th book, and I've been familiar with your work as we've discussed throughout my career, really starting with your political history of the American Revolution, which is, you know, revolution all the way up to the end of the War of 1812, and, you know, cribbed from that extensively for my own lectures and assigned that for readings, and then other works on Jefferson, Reputation, and Legacy and Reputation.
Yep.
Prior to this, your more recent book, which was Emperor of Liberty, which I really enjoyed. I thought it was wonderful. And when I read Revolutionary Friendship, I read it in the context of those works, obviously. And Emperor of Liberty really helped me make sense of a lot of what is discussed. And but could you give the listeners a brief overview as to what you were after in Revolutionary Friendship?
Sure. Thanks, James. And thank you for your kind words. So Revolutionary Friendship began, and I'll say this tonight, so you'll have to indulge me a little bit. I'll repeat myself for you today. But it began with a student question. So a student in my class on the American Revolution in Edinburgh asked me about the relationship between Thomas Jefferson and George Washington. And I gave them an answer, which was pretty standard, kind of the, if you will, the textbook answer, that while they disagreed over politics and late in life, they became estranged. And, you know, they weren't terribly close. And I got back to my office and I thought, I wonder if that's true. So students ask questions. They're really important.
Yeah,
that's
sure.
The one lesson. Yeah. And so I began to look into this and I searched the literature. And to my surprise, and I should have known this, there was no book there was then no book length study of the relationship between Washington and Jefferson. We've got lots of books on Hamilton and Jefferson, yeah, and Jefferson and Adams, and Washington and Hamilton, and so on and so forth. Almost every combination you can think of, except on Washington and Jefferson. And so that was my point of departure a few years ago. And I began with a student question that was a really good question, in fact, it turned out. And so, that was the start. And it built on, as you said, my background, I suppose, over the past 15 to 20 years has really been Jefferson focused. So it was interesting to study somebody different for a change.
Sure.
Approaching it from Jefferson's perspective, if you will, but reading a lot about Washington.
Right. And in typical Dr. Cogliano fashion, this is, you get five books in one. You really do. A really serious history of the revolution, the early parts and those fundamental parts. You get a lot of micro histories in there about really interesting, a lot about Phyllis Wheatley, which is incredible. The Henry Hamilton, I've called it the Henry Hamilton affair, but that was an interesting sort of aside to talk about Washington and Jefferson. We could talk about that in a second if you don't mind. Just really good biographies too, that tell, you know, about their sort of emotional connections as much as anything else. And these are really serious guys who grow to have these, I'd say, diametrically opposed on the surface kind of opinions of the trajectory or how the Constitution should be interpreted and how that preserves liberty. And on the one hand, you have I'll let you tell the story. But on the one hand, you have Jefferson, who believed that the country should be Virginia in miniature, and on the other hand, you had Washington, who was affirmed nationalist and who had the benefit of leading the nation's army into war and rallying troops from all over the country. But also, so and throughout the book, I made notes of, you know, the similarities and differences in there. I thought maybe this is a little discursive, so I'm glad you're staying with me. If you could talk about their similarities, because early on, you know, you call them cousins, and I love the name there. But and how you're thinking about cousins and their relations. They're both from Virginia, both planted elite. Slave owners, and they're from the kind of upper. Could you talk about their similarities, and maybe we'll talk about their points of divergence?
First. Sure, of course. So they are similar in that they both represent that Virginia planting elite. And I think that's really, really important. And I use the term cousins deliberately. I was trying to think, how do we characterize this relationship? Because there's an 11-year age gap between the two. So, and Washington is the older of the two. So it's not really a father-son deal. Although Washington was often seen by as a father figure to some of the members of his so-called military family, so Hamilton, Lafayette, and so on. So the father-son thing doesn't really work. I don't see them as revolutionary brothers, to use Joseph Ellis's term, because Washington is the older of the two, but he's also, certainly when they meet, and for most of the time they interact, superior is the wrong word, but he's the alpha dog, and everybody knows it. And so it's not necessarily like a fraternal link. And I use cousins for a couple of reasons. One is they actually were cousins. Very
11th cousins,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, 11th cousins. Yeah. So they've got a common forebear.
Did you do that? Did you do that work?
Genealogy? I did the work in the sense that I did research. There are lots of genealogical studies of American presidents. Right. So I did the work in the sense that I went to the library.
Sure. Okay. Fair enough.
But they are 11th cousins. Yeah. So they are actually cousins. Yeah. But cousin also in cousinage works on two levels, I think, for the book and the way I think about their relationship. One is members of that Virginia elite, and one sees this in the 18th century, not just in Virginia, but in other colonies as well. People refer to each other as cousin as a kind of term of endearment and a kind of, I don't want to push this too far, in the way that some guys today call each other bro, it's a little bit like that, hey, cousin or cuz. Right. And it's a signifier that we're in the same class and we kind of are equivalent to each other. We're on the level. And so it works in that way, in the way in the contemporary usage. We see this in Shakespeare, for example, where the term cousin appears. But also, I think it works in the modern sense. You know, a cousin that is, you know, when we speak of first cousins and their relationships, you I don't know whether you have cousins. I don't actually have cousins, which is a great regret. Both of my parents were only children. But my children have cousins, and I see their relationships. And with cousins, you have a kind of bond, cousins in our sense, first and second cousins, particularly first cousins. You have a bond, you have a closeness. It's not as close as siblings, but you can drift in and out of each other's lives. It's closer than just a sort of friendship. But there might be times in your life where for reasons you're separated physically and not especially close, then you come together. Cousins sometimes disagree over politics, as these cousins will, and they will fall out, but they might fall back in when they meet again at another cousin's wedding or what have you. So I think the fluidity of the cousin relationship, the relationship between cousins in our modern sense of the term, works to help characterize this relationship as well. Mm-hmm. So I think it works both.
And that's always, by the parenthetically here, that's always how I've understood the origins of my last name, is that they were associated with someone else. Not really specific, but we're part of the good. We're the good guys.
Okay, that's right.
So they're both from that kind of landowning aristocracy. Early on, reading this for was you go in with certain assumptions and Washington's position, because ultimately where they end up is, Washington is more of a nationalist, and Jefferson, obviously a Jeffersonian Republican. And everything that is associated with the kind of you know, the monarchy and British royalty and everything that, that Americans kind of fear is used maybe not necessarily against Jeff Washington particular, but certainly his acolytes, so like Hamilton and other people who adopt this kind of Federalist moniker. People go, but so I was interested in Washington's you know, early kind of relationship with the British government. And obviously, he's, you know, kind of, you know, attempts a military career there. But does any of that influence his kind of perspective on the British and how he relates to the British?
Yeah, I mean, I think this would apply to both Washington and Jefferson, okay. James. So as members of that Virginia elite, they are oriented towards London. They're looking across the Atlantic for their clothes and books and furniture and things like that, the kind of stuff of life, if you will. And that's why they, you know, and their fortunes depend. They're both slaveholders, as you noted, and they both raise tobacco and later wheat, but they're dependent on that transatlantic relationship for their way of life or their ways of life. Mm-hmm. But they both become alienated from Britain in the end. Washington, to directly answer your question, he's a celebrity as a very young man because of his actions and during the early stages of the Seven Years' War, the French and Indian War, as it's known in North America. And he sought a military career in Britain, in the British Army. He sought a commission in the British Army. Jefferson equally, I think, was looking towards Britain in important ways. And I think, and here's my it's going to sound like a subversive thing to say with 2026 and the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence in the offing. I think for both of these men, the early stages of the Revolution are an admission of failure because they both conceived of Virginia and their lives in the context of the British Empire. So although they wanted the empire reformed and they didn't approve of the British taxes and all that kind of stuff, the Stamp Act and all the stuff we, you know, we talk about and we teach our students, they believed that the empire could be reformed from within. And to some extent, their acknowledgement that it couldn't, the moment they become Americans, if you will, is a moment of failure for them.
Right.
At least in the first instance. And they both will move beyond that and come up with, you know, they become fervent supporters of the American Revolution.
Could you remind me, where do they fall in with Dickinson's Olive Branch petition?
They support it because they recognize, you know, their adherence to the Whig ideology that says you know, before you take up arms, before you resort to armed resistance, you need to take the last step. It's not your first step.
Right.
And so they support it. But I think both of them at that point are pretty skeptical. You know,
right.
The war's already underway. And, you know, the British and American rebels are killing each other at that point. It makes it much more difficult to sustain after that.
But then that's such a, and you make that point, and it's a good point to make in the context of other points that you make, which is that, you know, their allegiance is to the king. And Parliament, they're the radicals. And when they're petitioning the king, it's really, hey, listen, your Parliament is out in left field, and we need
that's
to
right. They're leading you astray.
Yeah, right.
We're the real British. You know, we believe in British freedom.
Right, right.
Is so what we're trying to say.
The adherence. Well, so I mentioned, you know, all the interesting kind of past points of their lives. I don't know if that's a good term to use, but these different kind of circumstances that they find themselves in. Washington's gone from Virginia for 7 years. So, you know, Martha visits him at Valley Forge and other places. And I grew up right across the street from Valley Forge.
Okay.
I don't think I told you that. And played on the cannons when they used to have the replica cannons out. I got my first bee sting from a cannon at Valley Forge. But all these, so the Henry Hamilton affair, could you talk about that? And I think this will be really interesting to listeners. Just the, you know, how on the one hand you can really hate your enemy and fight tooth and nail. On the other hand, you know, they're just kind of living among you. You know, especially the officers are quartering, you know, in your streets. And then who Harry Hamilton is and how he, you know, sort of brings out this early phase of Jefferson and Washington's relationship.
Sure. And thanks for asking this, because I think it's a really interesting and revealing moment in the evolution of their relationship. So Henry Hamilton was a former British Army officer who becomes governor of Detroit. So he's in command of the British settlements around Detroit in modern Michigan. But he's got a broader remit than that because he's essentially responsible for British authority in what will become known as the Northwest Territory, but the kind of, if you will, the area, kind of broadly speaking, north of the Ohio River. And east of the Mississippi, and south of the Great Lakes. So it's the North, what will become known as the Northwest Territory during the War of Independence. One of the things that the British and the Virginians in particular do is wage war, quite bloody war, on both sides of the Ohio River in Kentucky, where we are today, and Ohio. And they do so by using local militias of settlers, but also Native American indigenous allies. And it's quite a bloody and nasty war. It's a kind of war within the War of Independence. East of the mountains, we have the kind of wars people know, but think about it, you know, the big battles are mostly there. Out here, it's a much more bloody guerrilla war between settlers and Native peoples to a large extent. So Henry Hamilton is in command of the British forces in the Northwest. And he emerges as a real villain in the minds of Virginians and Virginian settlers here in Kentucky in particular. And when Jefferson was governor of Virginia, and he served as governor as a kind of disastrous period in his public life between 1779 and 1781, George Rogers Clark captures, on behalf of Virginia, not the Continental Army, captures Hamilton and brings him in chains to Williamsburg and Richmond, where Jefferson was serving as governor. Jefferson then is faced with the dilemma what to do with him. Now, Jefferson encountered lots of British officers during the war. After General Burgoyne's army surrendered at Saratoga in October of 1777, a lot of those troops ended up as prisoners in Charlottesville, Virginia, where Jefferson lived. And Jefferson consorted with their officers. And had dinner, yeah. Played music.
Yeah.
And so the expectation is that that's how he's going to treat Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
Hamilton, however, as far as Jefferson is concerned, is beyond the pale because his nickname among Anglo-Americans was the hair buyer, that he had, according to their beliefs, encouraged Native peoples to kill women and children in Kentucky and in Ohio and on the Virginia frontier and paid bounties for their scalps. And so as far as Virginians was concerned, including Jefferson, this was unacceptable. He was an order of magnitude worse than other British officers.
Mm-hmm.
And so Jefferson orders him confined in chains in a cell and denied pen and paper and basically says, no, we've got to punish this
guy. He's a legitimate prisoner.
He's a legitimate prisoner. And we're going to treat him like a prisoner.
Yeah.
He writes to Washington about this because Washington is the commander of the Continental Army. Again, this is a Virginia problem Hamilton was captured by Virginia troops and he's being imprisoned by the Commonwealth of Virginia, not by the Continental Army. But Jefferson writes to Washington because he's the commander of the Continental Army to just say, well, this is what I'm doing with Henry Hamilton, just so you know. And Washington initially says, yep, okay, that's fine. However, Washington becomes concerned because the British, in response to the treatment of Hamilton, are imprisoning Virginia officers that they've captured from the Continental Army and holding them in confined circumstances in retaliation. And Washington writes to Jefferson, and there's a really interesting interaction that the two have. And the reason I concentrate on this in the book is because I think it's a kind of, it's a moment where they start to trust each other, even though they're disagreeing, or they come to disagree. And Washington respects Jefferson's authority as the governor of Virginia. He basically says, this is up to you. However, you might want to reconsider this because of the implications for Virginia troops. And Jefferson eventually ameliorates the conditions under which Hamilton is being held. Actually, sorry, that was a terrible sentence. We tell students not to use the passive voice. Under which he is holding Hamilton. Okay. Let's be clear about who's doing what to whom. So he basically improves Hamilton's conditions. And Washington writes to him and says, well, you know, Hamilton was in line to be, you know, they have this parole system where they basically trade prisoners. Hamilton was, it's surely time to free him. And, you know, we can trade him for Virginia officers in the Continental Army. And Jefferson initially says, no, we're not going to do that. You know, he still has to be punished. But eventually Jefferson comes around and accepts that. And so what we see is Washington did not say to Jefferson, hey, you need to do this. Because he respected his authority as governor of Virginia. But he did say, well, you might want to reconsider for the following reasons. And what's interesting is Jefferson listens to him. So it's a very, as you know, I go on at a little bit of length about this in the book because I think it reveals how their relationship operated. As well as being, it's an interesting and little known aspect of the War of Independence.
And it's a really cool, I'm sorry to interrupt it.
No.
But the trust, right? Because Washington does trust that Jefferson is not going to, you know, implode the entire war effort and trusts in, I think, executive authority, which is what I took from that. And then Jefferson can trust that a commander of forces will, you know, ultimately cede authority to executive power. And then that gives them, I think, a really good working relationship throughout Washington's tenure as president.
That's right. Yeah, I think that's right.
Ultimately his selection. There's a couple other things that I love the story of Citizen Genet almost more than anything else in the world. Because I think it is just such a great, you get everything. You get, you know, French arrogance. You get youthful sort of indignation, and you get just a really tough moment in America's history, trying to figure out what it's going to do, how it's going to navigate between, you know, the two world powers here, and what's in bounds and what's out of bounds. And this is I think for a lot of people that know the era, this is the first time that. You know, you really encounter a disputation between Washington and Jefferson. Could you tell us, you know, about Citizen Genet, what he was doing there? And I love the shipbuilding. You know, I love the idea that he's in Philadelphia Harbor and what he's doing there.
Sure. So Edmund Genet is the French ambassador to the United States in the early 1790s.
Young guy, right?
Young guy. He's a very young guy. Yeah. His backstory very quickly is he came, his father had been a translator at Versailles. So under the previous regime, under the pre-revolutionary regime. So Genet's a well-connected guy. And when the revolution in France comes, he sides with the revolutionaries and the Jacobins in particular. His dad was a translator. He himself is fluent in several languages. At one point, he's sent to St. Petersburg in Russia. But he's so offensive in his behavior there that they basically have to recall him. And they say, well, there's...
And then send him to America.
Well, they more or less say, okay, we can either execute this guy or we can send him to America.
Right.
And maybe for the Jacobins, there's no difference.
Yeah.
So they send him to America. Yeah. He goes to the United States, and he's a fervent supporter of the French Revolution, of course. And he turns up, and he arrives in Charleston, South Carolina.
Was that on purpose? I mean, he says he was blown off course, right? Because he was supposed to arrive in Philly.
He is supposed to arrive in Philly, because Philly was then the capital of the United States.
But he ends up in Charleston.
He ends up in Charleston.
So he can make this grand tour.
And he makes this tour.
Was that on purpose?
Who can tell? He said he was blown off course, but he goes to Charleston. He receives a hero's welcome there, and he begins outfitting. He's giving licenses to privateers, which are private vessels that basically act as licensed pirates. Mm-hmm. And he's saying, you can go attack British shipping in the West Indies, you know, and you can keep the rewards. This violates the neutrality of the United States. It causes all kinds of problems for the United, or potentially does for the United States. And then he goes on a grand tour overland from Charleston to Philadelphia, and he's feted along the way, and he's treated and he starts to think, oh, the people love me. Yeah. I'm incredibly powerful. Meanwhile, in 1790, Thomas Jefferson became the Secretary of State, the first Secretary of State of the United States. And he's serving as Secretary of State for George Washington. And Washington and Jefferson disagree on the French Revolution. Jefferson's more enthusiastic about it than Washington is. So Genet presents Jefferson in particular with a real headache because the guy's a pain in the neck. And when Jefferson, when he finally gets to Philadelphia, he's a number of meetings with him, and Genet's demanding this, that, and the other thing from the United States. He goes in to see Jefferson and says, we want you to repay the loans from the War of Independence immediately. We want you to outfit ships. We want you to do this and that. Oh, by the way, he's authorized to stir up wars in the western part of the United States with the Spanish and British.
Exceeds his mandate.
Yes, and he's a difficult figure. And Jefferson keeps saying, yeah, we're not going to do that. We're not going to do right. that. He puts him off. Yeah. But he really annoys Jefferson as well. So Jefferson runs out of patience with him. And Jefferson has to say to him, look, you need to cool it.
Yeah.
Calm down. And Genet says, I will go to the people over your head. And Jefferson says, you know, you're not more popular than Washington. You need to be very careful about this. Washington goes, it's in the summer of 93. I think Washington's in at Mount Vernon. And Genet outfits a privateer, a French private warship, in Philadelphia. And he says he's going to send it to sea. And Jefferson says, you can't do that. It violates the Neutrality Act. It violates, you know, American policy. You can't do it. And Genet is insisting on doing it. And they have a standoff over this, and Washington is furious. Now, one of the reasons I think this is an interesting story because of the individual's concern. This is a case where, although Jefferson and Washington had different views of the French Revolution, Jefferson sided with Washington. He didn't undermine the administration in this case. Basically, he tells Genet, you can't do it. Yeah. You've got to stop.
Yeah.
Eventually, the government, there'll be a change of governments in France. Genet will be recalled. There's a likelihood he will be executed if he returns to France. And Washington gives him effectively asylum in the United States. He lives another 30 years and you know, outside New York. But the Genet controversy is another case where I think we often see one of the themes of the book is Washington and Jefferson got along much better than people realize and for much longer than people realize because we're wedded to this narrative of their eventual estrangement. Sure. And so the Genet controversy is actually one where they get along and they cooperate. They're on the same page in that much more than one would think, despite the fact that they each have slightly different views of the French Revolution.
But it does really, I mean, and this is towards the end of Jefferson's term in office as Secretary of State. And I wonder if that episode and then the Whiskey Rebellion on top of that, if these things start to color his perception of, you know, this is it's a hard job. And there's also things in France at that point are really out of Jefferson's control. And Jefferson is someone who really lauded the French and the idea of, the Empire of Liberty kind of spreading, the idea of individual rights spreading throughout the globe. And this would be the end of all wars and so these grandiloquent ideas. And if that didn't really kind of work against that, and he just thinks, you know, this is not my moment in history. And that's part of the reason. Obviously, he has dust ups with Hamilton, too. There's going to be a question in this.
Okay.
But I think, you know, and you know, as I was reading, you know, these chapters, you know, you're looking for, okay, what's the definitive moment that really just kind of like Jefferson's out and he wants to go back to Monticello and, you know, live a life, exclusive of politics. And it was, to my mind, and maybe this is the question, you correct me if I'm wrong, but if it was, you know, these were cracks, and it's not great to, to have this wasn't a dust up, as you said, between the two, but, you know, it was an unflattering moment. Genet did not put the French in the best light, and then France at the moment wasn't putting France in the best light, the revolutionaries and, Reign of Terror. But the Whiskey Rebellion, too, which Jefferson was not really keen on the federal response.
Nope.
And then ultimately, what really fractures the two is Hamilton, Alexander Hamilton, and in their relationship. And Jefferson, you say, really never blames Washington. He blames Washington being manipulated by Hamilton. So do you see those three sort of moments as kind of culminating, or
or does one trump another?
No, I think instead of cracks as a metaphor, I'll use it's like a leak. Mm. So or a drip in your ceiling, right? So it's drip, 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 and it's a number of things. So it's the French Revolution, it's Hamilton's fiscal policies, it's Hamilton himself, it's a bunch of things. And although I try to argue they got along for much longer than people realize, Jefferson serves as Secretary of State from sort of May, June of 1790 until the end of 1793, so nearly 4 years. He officially demits office on January 1st, 1794. It's no one thing. It's a kind of accumulation of things. And eventually, like with a leak in your ceiling, you know, it's drip, drip, drip. You don't realize it's there. Then you notice, oh, there's a drip here. And then eventually the ceiling falls in, right? So I think it's a little bit like that. So it was no one thing. It was a kind of accumulation of things. Mm. What Jefferson can't accept is that Washington agrees with Hamilton more than he agrees with him. Mm. And so he starts to say, well, you know, he's lost a step. Maybe he's getting old. Maybe he doesn't, because he can't understand how Washington could choose Hamilton over him. And I'm not talking about personality. It's what Hamilton stands for in that Hamiltonian program. Right. There's a moment at Mount Vernon, I think it's in the summer of 1793, when Jefferson is talking to Washington about leaving office. And Washington had to be persuaded to run for re-election in 1792. And the people who persuaded him to do so were mainly Jefferson and Hamilton, who basically said, you got to keep the country together. And Washington's exasperated with Jefferson in the summer of 1793, basically saying, hold on, I'm in this mess because you persuaded me to do it again, and now you're going to bail on me. And that's when Jefferson agrees to stay till the end of the year. But the notes that Jefferson keeps of those conversations are very interesting, because he's saying, look, Hamilton and the other high Federalists want to kind of emulate Britain so much that there's a danger of a return to monarchy. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of counter-revolutionary threat. And Washington says to Jefferson, you need to calm down, son.
Yeah.
It's not that bad.
Yeah.
There's not, he says, there's not one man in America who anybody would take seriously who really wants to go back to monarchy.
Right.
And so that's when they become estranged. So it's not a single moment. It happens gradually. But even then, Jefferson can't quite bring himself to accept that Washington disagrees with him. He thinks he's being duped by Hamilton.
It does, it does sort of historically kind of rhyme with the, Clay Jackson kind of disputes. Henry Clay was absolutely convinced that Andrew Jackson was a monarchist and wanted to be a Caesar,
right?
A military dictator and come back in office. And that the rhetoric had risen to that level where it was so beyond personal. And so kind of I read it with that lens. But, ultimately you make the case that, they could have reconciled, as Jefferson and Adams do later in life to come back. So it never really reaches that fever pitch. You make a really good point in the book, and I'd never read these two documents kind of in parallel together. Maybe that's my own failings. But Jefferson's farewell and Washington's farewell and Jefferson's inaugural as kind of speaking. Now, obviously Washington passed away December 14th of 1799. So well before Jefferson's kind of inaugural speech is published. But Washington's farewell is kind of addressing these misgivings that you're talking about, this kind of monarchist sentiment. Could you talk about the kind of interplay there? And then we'll talk about Martha Washington and the second worst day of her life.
Sure. So first, just to briefly talk about their estrangement, happened. So in 1796, Jefferson goes into retirement, I'm using air quotes here, in the beginning of 1794. He returns to Monticello. So he's a private citizen. And in 1796, while he's a private citizen, he writes to his former neighbor, an Italian named Filippo Mazzei. And Mazzei had lived in Charlottesville and had been Jefferson's neighbor, and they were friends. And then he had returned to Italy. And Jefferson writes a letter to him, basically filling him in on what's going on in America. And he says, you won't believe what's happening. And he says, men who were Samsons in the field, a reference to Washington, have had their hair clipped by the harlot England.
This was what year?
1796.
96, and that's important.
It is important because he's a private citizen.
That's right. Okay.
He's a private citizen writing. And so he's obviously referenced the biblical Samson, yeah, and Samson loses his power when he gets his hair cut, and so on. And so he makes that reference. Mazzei shares the letter with friends in Italy. It's eventually published. It's translated from English into French and published in French newspapers. And then it's retranslated into English and published in American newspapers in the spring of 1797, or the summer of 1797. Jefferson at that point is the vice president of the United States, because right, he ran for president, yeah, against Adams in 1796 and he lost, so he became the vice president. And so now it appears that the vice president of the United States has attacked,
yeah,
the most popular, right, man in the country, who's right, now in retirement, George Washington. And the retranslation is less flattering. So it's really unfortunate for him.
And he writes, Jefferson writes and apologizes effectively.
Well, he kind of writes it's a little bit of a, I'm sorry if you were offended apology. Yeah. but yeah, he tries to, okay, patch things up, and he writes to him about peas and because right, they corresponded about, right, agriculture, yeah, right, and Washington doesn't really respond to that. And so they're estranged after that. And they never reconcile because of Washington's death in 1799. That one of the things I think is, because Washington was only 67 when he died, so he could have lived longer. Yeah. And had he lived longer, they may have reconciled in the same way that Jefferson and Adams, who famously fell out over the election of 1800, right, eventually reconciled, although it took 11 years. Yeah. I think they might have reconciled. And part of the evidence I give for that, to return to your question, is if one reads Washington's famous farewell address, which warns Americans against partisanship and, yeah, entangling alliances and so on and so forth, and one reads Jefferson's first inaugural, there's nothing in either of those documents that the other man would disagree with,
right,
I think. And so, yeah, the argument I make, and perhaps this is a lesson for our time, is they agree on much more than they disagree about. Mm. And we've kind of exaggerated the differences between them, because it's how we teach, right? I mean, right, we have to explain this and the difference. You've got to explain the Hamilton fiscal program and all this kind of stuff. And all of our students, if they haven't seen Hamilton, they've at least are familiar with the soundtrack. And so, you know, this is how we teach it. But I think it's exaggerated. I think there's much more common ground than not, especially after Jefferson serves as president and he realizes, oh, this job's actually quite hard. Mm. And when he's reflecting in retirement, he looks back and he says, you know, I knew Washington pretty well and I didn't agree with him all the time, but basically he was a good man doing a hard job well.
Yeah. And understood that position once Jefferson is off us.
Right.
And really, yeah.
Right.
And you know, the power of the executive to make really important decisions like acquiring, you know, an enormous territory and the latitude that executive power really needs. And do you see some of the relationship between Jefferson and his Secretary of the State kind of mirrored is the relationship between Washington and Jefferson kind of mirrored in Jefferson's relationship with members of his cabinet?
A little bit, although Jefferson's Secretary of State is James Madison, who's a very close friend of his. That is much more like the Washington-Hamilton relationship than it is like the Washington-Jefferson relationship. Jefferson's not as close with everybody in his cabinet, so others in his cabinet perhaps were more like his relationship with Washington. It's not a team of rivals, you know, to use a phrase of a later age and from a different book. You know, this isn't Lincoln bringing in people who are his political rivals. When Washington adds Jefferson to his cabinet, he thinks he's the best guy for the job. Sure. And I think he thinks...
There won't be partisanship.
Wrong about that. Yeah. But also, they have a very successful and quite deep relationship in 1789 and 90 when he appoints him to that role. And so he's not deliberately bringing a rival in, but they're not quite as close as Jefferson will be with Madison.
But does Jefferson set a mold? I'll ask it in a better way. Does Jefferson set a mold for the Secretary of State and what that office should be?
Yeah, I think he does. I think he does, especially, okay, you're the guy to take charge of foreign policy. Right. Yes, I think Jefferson is the first Secretary of State So they talk at Monticello of 1, 2, 3. He's the first Secretary of State, the second Vice President, and the third President. Mm. So it's one, two, three for these roles. Yeah. But as Washington's administration is really important because it sets precedent for everything that follows. Washington's setting precedents for subsequent presidents. Mm. And Jefferson is setting precedents for subsequent secretaries.
And there's a wonderful book that came out a couple of years ago on Washington's cabinet.
Lindsay Chervinsky's.
Yeah, really, really well done. Really interesting.
Yeah, great book.
Really enjoyed that. But the could you just sum up some of his duties as, and that you know is always surprising to me. I mean, the government is very small. Treasury is, you know, 3 or 4 people, including a clerk. And the Secretary of State's, their job, their function is not jet setting, obviously. I mean, there's a lot of grunt work. I mean, when Henry Clay occupies the office, this is one of his great regrets, you know, beyond being accused of a corrupt bargain with John Quincy Adams, is he gets into the office and there's a lot of, you know, signing of documents and just kind of rote diplomatic.
There's a huge amount of paperwork and very few clerks to do it.
Right.
At Princeton University Press, they're publishing the papers of Thomas Jefferson, and they've been working on this project since 1943. They're hoping to finish in the next decade or so. And there are multiple series going on. We don't have to go into detail about that, except to say the intention of that project is to publish every document that is legitimately Jeffersonian. One of the things they've cut out, because it would make it endless and not terribly edifying, are the kind of workaday stuff he had to sign and issue, the sort of documents he had to issue as Secretary of State, letters of patent, letters of mark, this kind of stuff. Right. So there's a huge amount of paperwork. For a time, the Secretary of State is also responsible for the post office. The government is very small. One of the challenges we face, I don't know whether you get this, but I certainly face it with my students, is the words we use are the same. So we think of Secretary of State. You think of, oh, that's like Colin Powell was or Anthony Blinken today. No, it's not the same job because the government was much different. We talk about the United States, Britain, and France. We think we know what these places are. Mm. It's very important to convey to students that in the late 18th and early 19th century, the United States is very weak. Yeah. It's got incipient power. Jefferson believes it's got a very powerful future. But it's not dictating what goes on in the Atlantic world. It's caught up in this superpower rivalry between Britain and France, for example. And so although we use the same words, president, secretary of state, it's a much, much different world than the one we inhabit. And it's what makes it interesting, frankly. Mm. But it's also a challenge when we talk about it.
Yeah. And just, you know, and that's the thing to really that I marvel over is the kind of tenuous nature of a republic, something that never tried before on this type of scale, held together with kind of duct tape and twine. And so fragile for so many reasons.
They believe republics are really fragile and that they have to be attended, that therefore they have to be attended to by virtuous. And by virtuous, they mean not just virtue in the way we use the term, but also informed citizens.
And right. And you know, why it's so interesting to look at Kentucky history in this period. Because, you know, not only is Kentucky just, you know, at the kind of bleeding edge of the frontier, they're also in one of the more vulnerable positions for a lot of reasons. And one of those is, you know, the Spanish conspiracy and Davis County, which we're in right now, the great Joseph Davies, you know, writes to Jefferson and warns him of this rabble rouser, Aaron Burr, who's, you know, traversing the Midwestern states trying to raise an army. You know, there's this guy, Blander Hassett, and doesn't know exactly what, and Jefferson, you know, essentially says, relax, I don't know what you want me to do with this. But there's a lot of great in Kentucky history. This is, as we wrap up, I mean, I just want to put a plug in for Kentucky historians of this era, because this really is, a really fertile period for Kentucky history. There's a lot going on. Kentucky's really does, for Jefferson, I think he represents the newness and the freshness of America, and America can be reborn out in the West. And that's a lot of the first sort of immigrants to the state, do is they come from far afield, or, you know, they're coming from you know, Constantine Rafinesque, who comes from, you know, Constantinople at the time, and Granville Patterson, who comes from Edinburgh, Scotland, and people that just want a new life and the freshness of opportunity here in the state. And that's what it provides. And that's what Jefferson really loves about Kentucky as much as anything. Professor Cogliano, I can't thank you enough for today. Thanks so much for your time. And I'd encourage everyone to pick up Revolutionary Friendships. Also, Professor Cogliano's podcast has just a little bit of larger of a listening audience than my own. And it's a wonderful podcast at the Whiskey Rebellion. I encourage everybody listening to check out Whiskey Rebellion. And he does that with another extremely well-known professor, David Silkenit. And did just modern issues kind of deconstructed historically is the best way to put it. And they just crested their 250th episode. And I have not listened to all 250. There's a special designation for people who have. But they're extremely well done. I'm working my way through them. I started a couple years ago, and I'm making my way through them. But thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, James. My pleasure.
Appreciate it.